Hi, everyone, and welcome to Remaking Tomorrow, a series of conversations about the future of teaching and learning. I'm Ryan Rudzeski, here with Greg Baer, and we're the co-authors of When You Wonder, You're Learning, Mr. Rogers' Enduring Lessons for Raising Creative, Curious, Caring Kids.
This is a podcast powered by Remake Learning, a network that ignites engaging, relevant, and equitable learning in support of young people navigating rapid social and technological change.
On today's episode, we're talking with Richard Culotta, CEO of the International Society for Technology and Education, or ISTE, a renowned expert in education policy, teacher preparation, and educational technology. He's also the author of Digital for Good, Raising Kids to Thrive in an Online World. Richard Culotta, welcome to Remaking Tomorrow.
Thank you. I'm so excited to be here with you guys today.
Richard, we're so glad to have you. You lead, as Ryan said, the International Society for Technology and Education, or ISTE, one of the largest, if not the largest, ed tech-focused nonprofit in the world. And we'll come back to ISTE in a minute, but before that, you were the Chief Innovation Officer for the state of Rhode Island, and before that, President Obama appointed you to the Office of Educational Technology at the Department of Education. You began your career as a high school teacher. Richard, at what point did you become interested in educational technology specifically? Was there a particular moment or tool that hooked you?
Yes, actually, it was when I was teaching high school. So I was teaching Spanish, and we were teaching Argentina's history about Argentina's dirty wars, a very rough time in Argentinian history. And it was boring. I was falling asleep. My kids were falling asleep. It was just not working. And I remember at the time, there was sort of a projector that had showed up in the school. Nobody had really used it yet. We didn't have Wi-Fi, certainly we didn't have in the building. But I thought, let me try something. And at the time, they had released some pictures of the people that had been taken advantage of in this really horrible time. And so I was able to download these pictures, set them to music. It turns out Sting had written a song about this and made it just a quick kind of multimedia presentation. Anybody today would look at it and roll their eyes and laugh at it. But I went and I played it the next day in class, and it totally changed the experience that we were having. We had kids that were saying, well, how could this happen? And how do we keep these things happening from the future? And all of these conversations started. And in that moment, I went, whoa, like there's something here. There's something here that can be used to really make learning feel relevant and meaningful in these kids' lives in a way that just can't happen when you're reading it off of a textbook. And that was sort of the start. And from there, I went on to explore more things and see what else could be done. But it was in that moment where I said, this transformed a difficult, kind of boring topic into something that those kids would never forget.
And of course, anyone familiar with the field, anyone remotely familiar with the field, knows that EdTech has just exploded since then. The sheer variety of tools out there is amazing, overwhelming, promising, maybe a little worrying all at once. Where does ISTE come in? How does it help the field make sense of all this stuff?
As you mentioned, there's been a great increase in the amount of technology available in schools and for learning, and that's great. The disadvantage is we moved so quickly over the last couple of years to make sure there's connectivity and tools in the hands of kids and software in the hands of teachers that we haven't necessarily taken enough time to make sure that it is being used well. And that's really the role that ISTE plays, which is saying, how do we help make sure the technology is being used in a way that can really transform learning, that can make it feel engaging and special, that can tie to students' interests and needs, that can help them be the creators and designers and explorers of the future, not just have content pushed at them. One of the things I often say is the least interesting thing we can do with technology is use it to present content to kids. Scanning worksheets and putting them on a screen, making long PowerPoints that we're clicking through on the screen, none of that is effective, curious learning. And also it's working with the companies that are building these tools to help them build better products. It goes on both sides. And I think if we can do that and if we can keep focused on that, we have a chance to have a very powerful tool to reimagine learning.
And Richard, when you think about quality in educational technologies and how we're using it to incite curiosity and creativity, ISTE has standards in place. Can you say a little bit about those standards and what they look like in practice?
So we have this thing called the ISTE standards, in fact, and they are a set of guidelines and signposts, if you will, for how to use technology in powerful ways. And so it'll be things like, one of the standards is called Knowledge Creator. And so it's saying, how do we help use technology with students so that they can create their own knowledge and their own learning materials, as opposed to just being presented content? It's things like Global Collaborator, which aligns in some ways very nicely with some of the points in your book, which is how are they learning to use technology to connect with their peers in their community, in other parts of the world? And so those elements of the ISTE standard set out guideposts for using technology in ways that can really empower students to be curious learners in the future.
Richard, a few moments ago, you mentioned the pandemic, and I think a lot of people hear the term EdTech and they think Zoom, right? They think online learning. And for lots of good reasons, the idea of online learning doesn't always have the most positive connotations. But you've made a really important distinction between remote learning and effective digital learning, the kind of learning that the ISTE standards help enable. Can you distinguish between the two for us?
Many people's experience with digital learning in some way, shape, or form happened because of the pandemic, right? And I want to be careful how I say this, because during the pandemic, there were a lot of things that were done with technology to help keep some sort of learning going in a very difficult time. And that's why I refer to that as sort of, emergency remote learning. And sometimes I compare it to like a tent. If you're out in the woods and you're hiking around and a big storm is coming and you know you're going to get trapped in the woods in a storm and you come across a tent, a shelter, that is an amazing thing. It's, potentially life-saving, right? It's a place to protect you from the elements and get you through a storm. And in a lot of ways, that's what web video-based learning experiences were like during the pandemic. But that tent is also not where you want to stay for the rest of your life. You want to live there, right? You're glad that it helped meet some basic emergency needs for you, but for the rest of your life, you want to live somewhere that does more than just meet your emergency needs. It's also inviting and a comfortable place and a place you want to invite friends. And so, you want a house with an inviting place with rooms that can support multiple types of activities. And that's the way I think we need to be thinking about using technology. It can do so much more and be so much more effective than the way that we were using it in that emergency time period. And so a lot of times I think we have to be careful that we don't oversample and think, wow, sitting on Zoom all day watching PowerPoints, that was a rough experience. We don't want to use technology for learning. No, we don't want to use that kind of technology for learning, but we do want to make sure we're still taking advantage of all of the powerful ways that technology can be really empowering. And one point that I would make out, just to maybe push this metaphor a little too far, is the fundamental difference between that tent in the woods and the beautiful house that you invite your friends over is one of them has a foundation, right? One of them is built on a solid foundation that allows you to build something much more beautiful and usable. And I think what happened during the emergency remote learning experience that we were in, we weren't using foundations of online learning. We weren't using foundations of learning science. We couldn't. We didn't have time to. We just said, hey, just make this work, right? But now we need to get back and say, hey, we know that if you can use technology to help kids really be the explorers, be the wanderers, right? That's very powerful. And now we have time to do it. And bluntly, thanks to COVID, we have the infrastructure to do it the right way. Like it or not, one of the things that COVID brought us was much better infrastructure for learning. But now it's on us to make sure we're using that infrastructure in ways that are really powerful and not slipping back into the tent in the woods time.
We've heard a lot of good metaphors on this podcast. That might be the best.
Okay, but I don't know much about tents. I do know a thing or two about books, though, Richard. And you are the author of a book entitled Digital for Good, Raising Kids to Thrive in an Online World. And all of us here, we're fortunate to be parents, and our kids are different ages, but it's fair to say that this digital world and how our kids interact with it is always on our minds. And for a long time, it's sort of been unclear what we as parents ought to be doing to equip our kids and help navigate them through this time. So as the author of this book entitled Digital for Good, what do you say to parents like us?
As my kids were growing and getting more access to technology, I was finding that in our family, we were struggling with some of these same questions. And at one point, my wife said, look, you spent your whole career at the intersection of young people and technology. How is it that you don't have all the answers, right? And so I went, well, clearly they're out there. And so I started to go around and do some searching. And what was shocking to me was the advice that is being given largely to parents, to families, about technology use in many ways is really contradictory to the underlying principles of effective learning that we know about. So that's what prompted me to write this book. Can we give some really not myth-based, but actual, you know, fact-based principles that can help create effective conditions, culture, for using technology in the home? One example is we know, and we have an innate sense as parents, that we need some moderation in our tech use. It's not healthy for a kid to sit on a device and use that device the entire day without ever taking a break. Like, we know that's not healthy. And so often you will see that families or, you know, parents will turn to time. We'll talk about screen time and using a timer as the tool to limit the technology use. And while that at first makes sense, if you dive into it, it's actually teaching a very problematic lesson, because it teaches kids that all things that happen on the screen are of the same value. And we actually want to teach the exact opposite lesson. That there are some activities that happen on digital devices that have deep value, you know, exploring, writing, talking with a member of our family, reading, it can be different in different contexts, right? And then there are some other activities that have very low value, playing a very repetitive game that doesn't involve much creative thinking. There's some great games out there, by the way. I love games, but some are just very repetitive, you know, Candy Crush or whatever your game of choice is, right? And those deserve very little time. And so I try to help us shift today. Instead of screen time, we should be thinking about screen value and what activities are getting the most value, and then using that as a tool to help create some better balance in our kids' lives. It's the idea of just saying, hey, let's move away from some of these myths, urban legends that keep getting promoted out there, and follow up with really practical guidance for creating a healthy digital culture.
This is Greg Baer along with Ryan Rudzeski. We're talking with Richard Culotta, CEO of the International Society for Technology and Education, or ISTE.
Richard, we can't talk about EdTech without talking about AI. So ChatGPT has been available to the public for a while now. And as amazing as that tool is, it's already been eclipsed by tools that are even more powerful than that. And these tools have huge implications for education for all sorts of reasons. But before we get to those, can you just tell us about your first experience with generative AI? Where were you? What'd you use it to do? And what was your reaction?
The second one is a little better. I'm going to tell you the first one to answer your question, but I'll give you the second one. So the first thing I did is I actually said, give me a bio of Richard Culotta, right? I was just curious to see what it would say, because I knew enough about me that I could tell whether it would be accurate or not. And so I did that, and it was fine. And I was actually impressed with what it said. But then my second response was, give the bio of Richard Culotta as if I were a pirate. And that was a great, amazing answer, truly. And it was very funny. If you haven't done that, by the way, ask it to explain the Electoral College to a pirate or something, right? Ye landlubbers be learning about, you know, education. And it truly was very funny. And then I also immediately after, I had early access to an image generator. I had the ability to explore creating images. And it just reminded me how powerful it can be, especially for young kids who have ideas in their minds, things that they can create, but they don't have the artistic abilities to be able to implement those yet. And so to be able to give them that power to say, now what you can imagine, we have a tool that can help you create, that is crazy powerful and really exciting.
Richard, you said this about AI. Quote, AI has the potential to be the world's most powerful learning tool, but only if educators and students understand how to leverage AI to support their learning needs. So given that until recently, AI was barely part of a conversation anywhere and now seems to be behind every single door and window, how do we build on that early understanding and do so at speed? This technology is moving so fast. Where do we even begin? How are you advising schools and educators and parents across this country?
Well, actually, we just put out a guide for school leaders specifically on how to bring AI into their buildings. And some of the advice that we give, one is, it's really critical that the adults in the system, us as either as parents or teachers or principals, are spending time to understand and explore what AI really is first. And that means really blocking some time to play around with it. I think we have a tendency as the older folks in the education system to judge these tools before we've even actually played with them very much. And so I think it's really critical to say, just explore for educators, for parents, spend some time trying out, pushing the limits of some of these tools. And don't just try, you know, ChatGPT, that's one we hear a lot about, but try some of the others. Try some of the tools that help bring text to video. Try some of the tools that help create images or audio and really kind of understand what the potential is. And then specifically for educators, we have a program called AI Explorations for Educators, which helps dive a little bit deeper into what's going on behind the scenes. Because it's critical if we're going to prepare young people to thrive in an AI-infused world of the future, that we're explaining to them and helping them know what AI is and what it isn't. It isn't magic. You know, magic is something you can't control. It's something mysterious. And AI is neither of those things. It is something that you can control. It is something that we can design and program to do what we want it to do, but only if we understand how it works, how it thinks, what its limitations are, how we can control it. And I'm really worried that we're not spending nearly enough time helping young people prepare to thrive in an AI world of the future.
So staying on this sort of AI track, Richard, we both had the pleasure of being at this year's ISTE Live, which is ISTE's massive annual conference that showcases all kinds of edtech tools and brings together some really brilliant teachers and educators. And at that conference, you unveiled something really exciting called Stretch. Can you tell us about that?
So Stretch AI is a prototype that we built, and what we were trying to do is show what we think will be the next generation of AI. It's a little funny to talk about the next generation of AI when the first generation is like, you know, 3 months old. But so what we've seen so far with AI tools is that they've been generalists, if we can compare them to people. You know, it's somebody who kind of just knows a little bit about anything, right? And I actually think the future of AI is going to be where AI shifts to being, you know, specialists. And so in this particular case, what we were demonstrating with Stretch AI is it's a tool, it's a chatbot tool, but instead of drawing from, you know, any information anywhere on the interwebs, right, it was pulling its answers specifically from content from ISTE and ASCD, which is the other part of our organization, that is created specifically by expert authors around learning. And so any answer that you ask Stretch AI, it's going to draw from just that material, not from anything around the web. And the other thing that we added to it was citations, because we believe that a critical piece of AI for the future, particularly in learning contexts, is the ability to see a list of the sources that were used to generate that answer. It's a working demo. We are still training it. It turns out, AI, it's a little bit like training a dog. You got to teach it and reward it to get it to do what's right. And every once in a while, it still pees on the carpet. And you got to, you know, fix it. And but we're working on that. We have about 1,000 teachers that have raised their hands and said, hey, we want to help train Stretch AI. And so we're going to be working to build it out. And the point will just be to show what I think will be a very exciting future of AI and learning, which are these very specialized AI tools that are designed around vetted, expert-created content and can be really helpful coaches for teachers and in some cases even parents.
A moment ago, Richard, you encouraged each of us to be a learner, right? Like dig into this technology, understand what it is, how it might be used. You now have 1,000 teachers demoing Stretch. How do you hope that something like Stretch will ultimately be used? In an ideal world, what will AI accomplish for and with educators and students?
You know, one of the things that I think is most powerful about AI is the ability to help us generate better potential solutions. Where you and I say, hey, well, let's think about maybe 2 or 3 possibilities and then pick one. We don't have the time or energy to come up with 100 possible solutions for every little thing. But if we can learn to outsource some of that solution generation to AI, we can come up with 100 possibilities and choose between the best of them. And so I'm really excited about that ability to say, hey, here's a new model that we're thinking about for learning. You know, what are better ways to do assessment of learning? You know, forever, testing has always kind of been the least exciting part of the learning experience. Why? Does it have to be? What if I could go to a tool and say, hey, give me 20 different ways that I could assess my students' ability to learn this particular topic and have it come back with some really great ideas that I just don't have the time to be able to generate on my own as a busy teacher. Those are the sorts of ways that I think it's going to be most powerful.
Richard, how can people find out more about the work you're doing and even get involved?
Well, the easiest way to do it is just go to iste.org/AI, and you'll see a bunch of the projects that we have going there, including a little bit about Stretch and some of the other initiatives. And it's a great way to be part of the community. Part of our job, I believe, very strongly at ISTE, isn't just to say, here's the solution, but to bring people together and help create a smarter conversation. The conversation right now is actually a really helpful step that educators can take.
Richard, before we go, we have just one more question for you, and you can decide whether you want to answer it like a pirate or not. What's one thing that parents and educators can do today to make tomorrow a more promising place for every learner?
One of the most important things that we can do right in this moment, as we're coming out of especially these last 2 years, which has been very difficult years and traumatic years, is to make sure that learning is a joyful experience. We don't talk about joy enough in learning. We talk a lot about measuring proficiency and making sure we're on reading level and grade level. And I don't think we're spending enough time saying, how do we make learning joyful? So sometimes I talk about what I call the DMV to Disney spectrum. If you go into DMV, the whole place is designed to make you feel miserable, right? The lines are long, the signs are scary, the counters are tall, the people are grumpy. Like, everything about it is designed to make you feel miserable.
And if you forget one little thing, you show up without the one thing you need, you got to start the whole process over.
Yeah, you got to start the whole process next Tuesday, right? Then if you look at an experience like Disney, where it's been designed to make it feel like a great experience. In both cases, you spend a lot of time waiting on lines, right? But the lines at Disney have been designed to not go back and forth, but they go in kind of non-traditional ways. So it feels like you're getting somewhere, and they have activities that are happening on the lines, and you have all of these elements have been put in place to help it be a great experience. I think that's what we need to be thinking about when it comes to how we're creating schools. And what I want to push us to is say, how can we make sure that the thing that we are creating is something that students want to be at the center of? And that comes down to really making sure it feels like a joyful, fun learning experience.
Richard, you just reminded me of a moment watching Don Marinelli, the co-founder of the Entertainment Technology Center at Carnegie Mellon University. There he was standing before about 50 superintendents, and he looked at them and he said, "Why aren't your schools more like theme parks? Why don't they have the joy and the wonder and the things that kids love about theme parks?" And there was absolute silence in that room.
100% agree, even to take it a step farther. So I did some work as a game designer in my past life. And one of the things that you look at is games, if you boil them down at the end of the day, they are a test. They are an assessment. They even have points, right? It is literally whether you're going to pass this level. And yet, we love to play games. You can't pry a game out of my kids' hands when it's time to go do homework. And so one of the questions that I like to pose is, why don't taking tests in school feel the same way?
Thanks again to Richard Culotta, CEO of ISTE and the author of Digital for Good, Raising Kids to Thrive in an Online World. Remaking Tomorrow is powered by Remake Learning. Learn more at remakelearning.org.